Грецию спасет. Россия уже 21 апреля...
Россия и Греция – братские страны, что Россия, Россия не враг.
Россия подписали важнейший меморандум
о отношениях между Грецией и Россией.
А Россия готова участвуть в тендерах по приватизации в Греции.
Кипр дал понять, он хочет сближения.
Nearly seven decades ago, an economically devastated Greece faced a communist insurgency and was one of the first fronts in the Cold War. In the spring of 1947, U.S. President Harry Truman asked Congress for and received $400 million in economic aid for Greece and Turkey to prevent them from falling into Moscow's orbit. Today, Greece is again on the ropes economically, and with a pro-Moscow government in power, it appears to be in play. With talks with the EU about a bailout to avoid a Greek exit from the Eurozone going down to the wire, Russia seems to be waiting in the wings with a big smile. Is the Kremlin preparing to make a play for Greece? And what would that portend? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galeotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the recently published book, Spetsnaz, Russia's Special Forces, as well as of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark. I've missed you, and I hope you noticed that plug for your book and see what a nice guy I am.
It's always appreciated. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you back. And also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, making his debut appearance on the podcast, is Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the books Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and the recently published The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. Welcome aboard, Dan. Good to see you after all these years.
Good to see you as well, Brian.
It's been a while. And I was really dying to say the titles of your two books together in tandem, because I thought that would be funny. Dan, we got an iron rule on the podcast. First-time guests get the honor of the opening question, so here goes. Unlike Mark and I, you actually study international economics for a living and have no doubt been following the ins and outs of the machinations of the Greek crisis. What's your sense? Is Moscow getting ready to make a play for Greece if things fall apart? I mean, this story is fluid as hell.
As we're speaking, we still don't know if there's going to be a deal to keep Greece in the euro. But to answer your question, whether Russia's making a play for Greece, I think the answer is no.
Okay.
For the simple reason that I don't think Russia can afford to make a play for Greece at this point. Greece has a serious there's a reason why the Eurogroup is acting so tough towards Greece. This is not to defend the Eurogroup, but rather to note that the Greek economy has a whole bunch of problems. And the other issue is the government of Alexis Tsipras is one that the Eurogroup doesn't trust. And from what I understand, Tsipras went to St. Petersburg. Was it last month for the St. Petersburg Economic Forum?
For the Economic Forum, yes.
Right. And, you know, the things I've heard is that trip did not go well for Tsipras in terms of what Putin was prepared to give him. So I think this is something where the Greeks want to give the impression that there is a Russia option, and I'm sure that the Russians are happy to talk up this option.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you're actually talking about tangible resources, the Russians are busy conserving their own, you know, conserving their hard currency for their own situation. I don't think they're going to suddenly, out of the goodness of their heart, decide that they're going to try to rescue Greece.
No, if it happens, I don't expect it to come out of their currency reserves. I mean, the noises that were being made this week, Sergei Sterchak, the deputy Russian finance minister, told Russian media, told TASS, that Greece could basically join the BRICS New Development Bank and get a bailout through that. And now that go, because I think I know what you're going to say. Well, that's great. That's great. Okay, this is the reaction of the economist. Right? Give it to me straight. Is that complete nonsense?
No, it's not complete nonsense. I mean, you're right. In theory, I suppose it could happen. But I want you to picture a world in which the BRICS Development Bank was set up for, among other reasons, a complaint that the international financial institutions were not loaning poor countries any money, particularly for things like infrastructure investment and so forth. So you're going to tell me that the first high-profile loan that the BRICS Development Bank is going to offer is to an economy that's in the OECD. Color me skeptical about this. As I said, this is what I think we are seeing is cheap talk. I mean, it is absolutely zero cost for Russian politicians to talk up the option of potentially helping Greece and potentially helping this government. I can see why, because again, it sows doubt and it gives, you know, it makes Russia seem like a better actor in the eyes of the Greeks and other countries that might be subjected to the Eurogroup's austerity measures. But are they actually ever going to commit any real resources? No, I'm pretty dubious about
it. Yeah, no, the thing that made me skeptical is to get this done through the BRICS New Development Bank. Of course, China would have to sign off on that, since China's the main financer of that bank, not Russia.
China and India and all the rest of them. And as I said, they're not going to say, oh, yes, absolutely, we should totally give our first, you know, big loan to Greece.
No, I mean, the only one that would be interested in the propaganda coup this would represent would be Russia, apparently, because it's clear that China and Russia are viewing these newly formed institutions like the BRICS New Development Bank very, very differently. Mark, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I very much agree. Look, of course, Russia is going to do everything it can to talk this off because it's a nice bit of mischief making. And it creates all sorts of overheated speculation in the West. Oh, my God, I don't know. The Russians are going to get a naval base in the Mediterranean or whatever. I mean, apart from the fact that Greece is already a NATO member, which actually might have some bearing on that. But anyway, the Mediterranean fleet of the Russians is hardly worth mentioning anyway. So obviously the Russians are going to play it up because it's a handy, cheap bit of mischief making. And likewise, obviously, the Greeks would have tried to play it up as a sense of, look, you really need to be nice to us, Europe, because otherwise we might have some new best friend. There is very, very little substance to this, as near as I can see.
No, I mean, if you look at the Russia, I just jotted down some of the headlines in the Russian media this week. Russia 24, the Russian 24-hour state-run news channel, has Greece almost over as their banner on there for their Greece coverage. Komsomolskaya Pravda, Greek tragedy, divorce already near, and Izvestia, the crumbling empire, an obvious reference to the European Union. Well, that said, though, the ruling Syriza party in Greece and Alexis Tsipras have close ties to Russia, have expressed ideological affinity for Russia, and there are a lot of ties here. What if this all falls apart with the European Union this weekend? Because we're really coming up against it right now. I mean, if they don't reach a deal this weekend, Greece is going to exit the Eurozone. Greece is going to default. Then what? Does Moscow step in if this all falls apart? Because this, I agree with you both, this is posturing before. But what happens when crunch time comes? When Greece is really out of the Eurozone? Is it realistic for Moscow to move in either unilaterally or through the New Development Bank?
Well, Dan can speak much more clearly about the economics. But I would say, I mean, two things. One is, of course, the current Greek government feels more of an affinity with Russia. And in part, that actually reflects what Greek society is. I mean, it's quite striking that at a time when you have very strong skepticism towards Russia across Europe, the most recent, last year's sort of Pew poll of attitudes said the Greeks actually 61% were favorable towards Russia, 35% unfavorable. And that's while the Ukrainian conflict was going. So, yes, it's all very, you know, that's all very well. But when it comes down to it, if actually Greece exits the Eurozone, if this leads to some crisis within the European Union, which it could well, in some ways, from Moscow's point of view, the Greeks sort of done their job. It's hard to see what advantage there could be, even if Moscow was willing to, in effect, take money away from Russian pensioners to pay it to Greek pensioners. It's hard to see what real advantage there would be. Okay, so maybe you can get the Greeks to say, we're going to be opposed to European Union sanctions. I mean, the amount of traction that Athens will have in European Union politics is, I think it's fair to say, pretty limited. So from my point of view, I still keep coming back to the fact of, given that this is not something that is easily or cheaply fixable, from Moscow's point of view, it really just wants to encourage chaos rather than take over some new ally/client state.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I have to agree with Mark here. I mean, on a couple of fronts. First of all, in some ways, the last thing Russia wants is for Greece to be out of the European Union. It would much prefer Greece to be inside the European Union for, in fact, those public opinion numbers that you talked about. Because, again, for the European Union to do anything like, let's say, I don't know, re-up sanctions 6 months from now, it needs unanimity to do that. So if Greece were kicked out of the euro, you know, not just out of the eurozone, but out of the European Union, that would increase the likelihood that sanctions would stay in place. And I guarantee you that for Russia, the prize of – and I put – I have air quotes when I say prize – of Greece as a client state for Russia, it pales in comparison to the prospect of getting the EU to lift sanctions off of Russia. So in that sense, that's much more important. And it would be better for Russia to have Greece inside the European Union being able to lobby for the removal of sanctions rather than trying to truly pry Greece away and create a client state out of it.
Well, then let's follow through with that, because I tend to agree with both of you as well. It does benefit Moscow much more to have Greece in not just the European Union, but in NATO as well. And my sense is that Moscow is would be happiest if they patched together some solution here, not least of all because Moscow's a little bit exposed here too. It has currency reserves and denominated in euros, of course, and it would be a bit exposed here. So let's talk about this bit of a Greek Trojan horse, if we can call it that, because Mark, those numbers are correct. And if you look back, even during the Cold War, Greece wasn't not entirely a trusted Western partner. There was this piece in the Daily Beast. I know, Mark, you were a little bit skeptical of it, the piece by John Schindler. One of the arguments in this piece, what did ring true with me, is that the lack of trust NATO officials feel toward Greece, especially right now, the reluctance to share intelligence with them, the notion that Greece is a bit of a playground for Russian spies, and that has only increased since Syriza came to power. What about now, Mark, you're the spook expert. What about all that?
Well, look, Greece has always been a playground, frankly, for bad actors of every kind. I mean, it's absolutely, I don't want to say open secret. It's not even a secret.
That should, by the way, be the logo for Greece now, the tourism. You know, the tourism. Greece, a playground for bad actors everywhere.
Absolutely, yes, quite. You know, it was always well known that if you want a European Union passport, a Greek one is the easiest and cheapest to buy. And, you know, so that it's not just the Russians, it's everyone. But the point is, for that very same reason, in some ways, Greece has for a long time already been under a certain degree of an internal cordon sanitaire. Exactly. That although the Greek security apparatus, I think, isn't quite as leftist as the government, but nonetheless, it doesn't have the best reputation for security. I mean, and that's actually within NATO headquarters, which I would hesitate to say it leaks like a sieve, but certainly it's been known to have one or two holes anyway. So I think for all these reasons, Greece has always been, shall we say, a problematic or put another way, weak ally. And has been treated as such. But I think NATO is quite used to dealing with, shall we say, variable geometry partnerships. The same way as Turkey, NATO member, but one that has distinct interests and awkwardnesses about dealing with it from the long time. So, yes, of course, the more Greece is in chaos, the more disgruntled it is with its relationships with the Western world, there may be some scope for increased opportunities. But to be perfectly honest, again, if we're talking about holy grails of intelligence, what Athens knows is probably not really in that category.
Right. So that's by design, and that's been a long-term trend.
I'm never getting to Greece. Never mind. You're
never going to get a Greek visa, my friend. But you don't need a Greek visa. You're an EU citizen.
And so are they so far.
Mark, would you say that this? I mean, are we seeing a qualitative change in this now? Has it gotten worse under the Syriza government under Tsipras, or is it just the same as it ever was?
It's too soon, really, to be making any such comments. I mean, not least because a lot of the people who are passing judgments suitably anonymously, alas, are the kind of people who anyway don't like the Tsipras government, and therefore they're much more likely to give it no benefit of the doubt. But on that said, I mean, I would just make sort of one caveat, which I said, is that we shouldn't rule out the fact that there are professionals within the Greek government structure, there are professionals within the Greek security apparatus. So even if the Tsipras regime is quite close to Moscow, that doesn't actually necessarily translate to government ministers handing over photocopied secret documents. But the main thing is, as I said, I think for some time, Greece has been regarded as a weak link and therefore really hasn't been given access to the sort of stuff that the Russians really, really want. So is there probably a slight drift? Absolutely. I mean, generally speaking, whenever you have a government that can scarcely pay the salary of its public servants, you can expect that to be a security issue. Whether, though, it is dramatic and whether it's a political rather than economic question, that's another matter.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, any thoughts?
I think the way I would put this is that the real question is not what happens when, you know, what would Syriza turn to Russia if they get kicked out of the Eurozone or if they get kicked out of the European Union? I think the question asked before that is does Syriza get kicked out of the Greek government if that happens? So, I mean, admittedly, they just, you know, won an overwhelming referendum. But I think if you're talking about a world where the banks stay closed for a long period of time, I'm not sure how the hell Syriza maintains its popularity.
Well, what's interesting is the numbers in that referendum, it was 60% roughly, if I remember correctly, roughly 61, coincide with the numbers Mark was citing, the poll numbers Mark was citing about the percentage of Greeks that have a positive view of Russia. And if
coincidence, Robert.
Yeah, I was gonna say, come on.
It's not. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think they're the same. We're talking about the same people here. No.
No. I mean, let me put it this way. It's certainly possible. But again, I think the problem was that the referendum vote. You know, again, you call a snap referendum in a week without voters having any, you know, understanding of what the ramifications are. If there is no deal with the Eurogroup. It's different with you if you're voting then than if you're voting in a world where you literally cannot get your money out of the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it looks like that's the world we're sort of slowly migrating towards. And, you know, what will inevitably happen is that there might be a quick rally around the flag effect, much like we saw with the referendum, but I don't think that's going to last.
And then you see this government falling and things going back to status quo ante.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, you really want a scary answer is that you have Syriza fall, you see a rejection of the mainstream parties, and you see a return, you know, a rise of some ultra-nationalist party.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, going back to Moscow, which Moscow has been working overtime to establish close ties with parties of the extreme left and the extreme right in Europe.
Right. There are ways in which I would argue it would strike me that the extreme right is actually better, more ideologically simpatico with Vladimir Putin than the extreme left.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you as well. Mark, any last thoughts before we move on to the second half?
Yes, I mean, just very much to endorse and piggyback off what Dan just said. I mean, in some ways, it's actually quite charming the extent to which Tsipras's leftists see a common spirit in the Kremlin. Because, you know, it is entirely based on a kind of bizarre mythologized past notion of the Soviet Union rather than anything else. And in that respect, I mean, I think that in some ways, again, actually one could say that what's happening in Greece is a challenge. A challenge for Russia as well as a challenge for the West, obviously. But a challenge for Russia in the sense of here we have people who are saying, you know, we're Orthodox like you. We are leftists like you. I mean, God bless them for thinking that. But nonetheless, that's the kind of emotional appeal. We have already seen at the St. Petersburg Forum something of a rebuff. I mean, there's talk of this 2 billion
this
euro
2
pipeline.
Billion euro
but
pipeline.
Yeah, you know, fine. But that's questionable. But the point is, it actually sort of more or less puts Moscow in this position. Up to now, it has basically exactly, it's cultivated all these rightists, leftists, marginalists, anti-Europeans, all kind of bizarre tinfoil hat wearers of every kind. And it's been able to do so because, in a way, it's never had to back up its blandishments with any actual realities. Now, actually, you have the Greeks saying, look, you know, you don't like the European Union, you don't like what's going on, we're asking you for something. And if Moscow then backs away and says, oh, no, sorry, mate, we were only using you as this Trojan horse, then I wonder actually what that means in the future when you actually have serious groups that might actually be thinking about national leadership, whether they'll suddenly think, come to think of it, actually, Moscow is just basically yanking our chain.
Mm-hmm. I mean, go ahead, Dan.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, in some ways, piggybacking on that, the other thing I get the impression of talking to people who have had to deal with Syriza is that the one way in which this government is truly different is the extent to which they are all, for lack of a better way of putting it, amateurs. They're amateur politicians in the sense of they've never actually had to govern a country before, and they've never had to negotiate at the international stage before. And as near as I can determine, that is truly frustrating the hell out of the Eurogroup and Washington as well, in the sense of they really don't know. I mean, there is such a thing as a professional politician, and Syriza has almost none of them. And I do kind of wonder if that's also weirdly what's going on. That's how the Kremlin is reacting as well to Syriza, which is that, you know, they're Vladimir Putin, say what you will, is a professional politician. I think I kind of wonder if he looks at the Greeks and thinks, I can't do business with these people. I can have fun with them, but I can't do business with them.
On that note, we'll shift to the second half. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and shift gears and take a look at Moscow's efforts to create an alternative to Western international institutions, an effort that was on display during the BRICS summit in Ufa this week. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the recently published book Spetsnaz, Russia's Special Forces, as well as of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts is Daniel Drester, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the books Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Деловая программа саммита БРИКС.
Саммит БРИКС в Уфе был весьма насыщенным, начиная со
банк развития БРИКС. Сначала
Россия, Китай, Индия, Бразилия и ЮАР сейчас общаются.
Не пытаются что-то развивать.
For the past couple days, Vladimir Putin's been basking in the glow that comes with hosting back-to-back international summits. Putin was hoping to use the BRICS and Shanghai Cooperation Organization summits to showcase Moscow's efforts, together with China, to establish alternative international institutions. It's not quite a new Bretton Woods, but BRICS did unveil its new development bank to finance infrastructure projects and a $100 billion special currency reserve fund to protect members against global liquidity risks. Dan, what's your sense? Does this all have legs? Can Russia and China actually create alternatives to the IMF, the World Bank, the EBRD, or is this just another mirage like the Greek thing?
No, this is, I think, something more than a mirage like the Greek thing. I think it is possible for China to create parallel institutions that could act as either a hedge or a substitute for the international financial institutions. And notice that I stress the word China there as opposed to Russia, because I think in some ways the alternatives are not necessarily the BRICS Development Bank, or for that matter, the SCO. I think it would be the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank.
Exactly.
Or the Silk Road Initiative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the way to think about this, which is China's certainly happy to create the new development bank and to create the contingent currency arrangement. But increasingly over the last year, they have focused much more on the AIIB than the NDB. And I suspect that's where they're – and furthermore, the One Road, One – I'm screwing up the name of it.
Yeah, I know. It's the Silk Road Initiative.
Yeah, the Silk Road Initiative.
But it's got a title.
One Road, One Port
something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the two I think they're going to direct far more resources to. That last one does, you know, dovetail nicely with the Russia's notion of the Eurasian Economic Union. But yeah. I think that's where you're going to see the priority of resources, not towards the BRICS at this point.
Mark, what does this say, do you think, about the Russia-Chinese partnership? I'm working on a blog along these lines right now, so I have some things to say about it, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Yeah, I mean, again, just to sort of follow this One Belt, One Road sort of initiative.
One Belt, One Road, thank you.
God, that was killing me.
No, I mean, if one thinks about it, really what that actually means is let us create routes that allow Chinese goods to go out and the raw materials that we want to go in and investments to sort of spread out. This is very much a Chinese instrument that in the process it can be very helpful to those countries in the Silk Road band. But nonetheless, when it comes down to it, the Chinese are not doing it out of altruism. So, I mean, for me, this is the key thing. I mean, I know I've said in the past that sort of, you know, China is not Russia's friend, but it's loan shark. And very much that's my view. I mean, actually, at the moment, Moscow still seems to think, still has this belief that it is somehow in if not in command of the relationship, but at least is able to define it. But when it comes down to it, I mean, I think we're soon enough going to see Moscow in a position where actually it has to think either we are forced to be dependent upon the West and Western institutions and an international regime that really was shaped by the West, or we have to become dependent upon China. This is not an alliance. I mean, I think these are institutions which actually matter. Even the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, I mean, I think it's quite interesting that you've actually got India and Pakistan both wanting to join.
Although that was a function of actually Russian Sino-Russian rivalry within the,
yeah.
Because Russia wanted to bring India in to counterbalance China, and China said, fine, we'll bring Pakistan in to counterbalance India. So
it's an example of the fact that actually Russia couldn't define the relationship as it hoped, but it's also an example of the fact that this is a club that people want to get into.
Mm.
This is a club that actually you can have people who have, you know, ample numbers of, you know, rivalries and a lot of bad blood, but nonetheless they see that this is important and they're joining and it's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's not the Moscow Cooperation.
No, and Moscow's not calling the shots here. Everybody's playing their own game. The Kazakhs are playing their own game there, and then the Chinese have recently been losing interest in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, even though it was once their pet project.
Well, I would say it's not so much that they're losing interest. Again, it's that they are, in their own way. I mean, again, the Chinese way of approaching things is rather different from the Russian one. I think it's just that they're working on a way of basically reprofiling the SCO. Whereas Moscow saw it as this kind of big thing that more or less, you know, it was the Asian Yalta. It was Moscow and China, or Moscow and Beijing deciding what's going to happen in Asia and Eurasia. Well, clearly that's not the way the Chinese want to take it forward. So, I mean, I think they still see it as a useful forum which can bring together quite often antithetical groups and having various roles, such as including counterterrorism cooperation and other security issues, but that it should not be considered a decision-making body. So I think that's what the Chinese are doing. They're kind of demonstrating lack of interest simply as a way of actually making it clear that no decisions get made there. It is merely a forum.
I mean, it also seems to me that I mean, Russia's clinging to BRICS in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as these like main vehicles of their foreign policy now, almost, where China seems to see them as a couple of many things it's using to bolster its influence. No?
Yes. I mean, that's basically what's going on. China has far more options in terms of its capabilities and in terms of setting up alternative institutions. And furthermore, it's not like, as I said, the other difference is that, at least in terms of you know, both ideology and rhetoric, Russia clearly wants to create real full-blooded alternatives to sort of, you know, pre-existing both security and international economic structures. I think China is curious about that, and I think there is an element to which they want to do this. But even if they do want to, they also have different strategic aims in doing so. I think one of their purposes is to do this with the notion of trying to signal to, let's say, the IMF or the World Bank, hey, how about you finally implement that quota reform and give us a larger voice in these institutions as well? So China simply has a far wider range of options in terms of what they can do institutionally than Russia does, which is why, again, you know, you're seeing China also play up the AIB and the One Belt, One Road initiative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yeah, Russia, I think Russia, this is one of Russia's, you know, few. The BRICS is one of Russia's few sort of alternative policy levers that it feels like it can raise. But the truth is that it's being eclipsed by these other non-Western institutions as well.
Well, there's a fundamental irony here, too. It's Russia that is completely incapable of setting up these alternative international financial institutions is eager to do it. And China, which is perfectly capable of doing so, is biding its time. And I think what that points to is that China is a confident rising power that really feels no need to take the West on directly right now, while Moscow appears to be a desperate falling power that is desperate to take on the West right now. No?
Well, Yeah, I mean, the line I always use is that China is rising but not revisionist, and Russia is revisionist but not rising.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
You know, that's the way I would think about it. I mean, I would say China is less insecure. China has its definite insecurities, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think the difference is that China has not rejected the sort of, you know, the sort of U.S. created world order in the same way that Russia has. China recognizes the benefits of that system to itself, and therefore, I mean, I think in some ways a lot of these structures are, in some cases, it's frustration because, I mean, they have a legitimate beef when it comes to things like infrastructure spending and finance and so forth. But in other cases, these structures sort of form a break glass in case of emergency, mm-hmm. in case there is a rupture down the road, which is prudent from China's perspective, whereas Russia wants to break the glass now.
Right, right. I mean, he also said that China fully understands that it benefits from the stability and can, to put it in IR terms, it can free ride on Western, yes, hegemony right now, because, yeah, it's not quite ready to take over hegemony. Well, right. Yeah. Well, Russia is like you said, wants to break the glass. Mark, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a school of thought that says what we're actually seeing in Moscow is a shift from a Euro-Atlantic to a Euro-Asian approach, which I think is wrong. I think one of the key issues is that Moscow still is looking at its Asian relationships and BRICS as instrumental. Its real focus is Europe and the United States. Mm. And it is still considering these as levers or reservoirs of support or allies in the prosecution of that crucial relationship with the West. Now, the irony is, I suspect that China likewise, you yes. know, is actually looking much more towards North America and maybe even Europe. So the interesting thing is you actually have this sort of what is apparently within the rhetoric of this grand Eurasian relationships. But really, when it comes down to it, it's not actually what anyone is primarily interested in. And again, when it comes to that, as soon as you're on to talking about those kind of relationships, well, clearly China has a much, much stronger relationship in every sense with the West, except as an antagonist. Because there is a relationship within antagonism, because it actually means Russia has something it can offer. But at the moment, that's it. When it comes down to it, China has economic weight. Russia can just simply say, I can stop being a pain in the backside. Mm-hmm. And I think that also really illustrates the respective weights of those two powers.
I mean, do you agree that Russia does want to break the glass right now, or is this a bluff?
I think Russia is a highly revisionist power. But again, I'm not convinced that it necessarily wants alternative order. I can't help but feel that actually Russia's ideal is a lack of order, not in the economic sense, obviously, but in a political sense. It's actually quite comfortable with failing institutions rather than creating strong alternative ones, because as soon as you have alternative institutions which are strong, they are also constraining. Mm. And, you know, therefore they limit Putin's mantra of Russian sovereignty.
Well, let's because this is getting interesting. Let's push this a little farther then, because
well, it's nice to know that the rest of it wasn't.
No, the rest of it was, but this is something I'm, as I'm looking at the Russia-Chinese relationship, I'm expecting 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, I don't know how many years down the road, we're going to basically, you could take today's broadcast from Russian state television that slammed the West in some way or another. I'm not sure which, because I didn't watch it today. But and you could just substitute America, China for America in every one. I mean, about China is going to be encroaching on Russia's sphere of influence in Central Asia. You watch. That's they're going to be saying that these Chinese created alternative global financial institutions are going to be the objects of Beijing's hegemony. Are we gearing up for a Sino-Russian conflict down the road, similar to the one we're seeing with the West right now? Because, like Mark, you pointed out, Russia basically could subjugate itself one way or the other.
Potentially, that's absolutely the case. I mean, but again, that presupposes that the Russia down the line is today's Russia. I mean, mm-hmm. absolutely. Yeah. If you could just sort of create some huge H.G. Wellesian time machine and move Vladimir Putin 10 years, right, 15 years right. forward, then that's exactly what we get. My hope, and to be perfectly honest, my expectation is that we'll have a rather different Russia. In place by that point, that this current spasm of authoritarianism, which is in some ways still sort of working through the end of empire and such like, will have worked through at least enough that there will be a rather different regime, which, yes, might well be chafing at the fact that Russia is the bigger, Russia is the weaker party compared with the Chinese economy and just simply the gravity, the simple force of gravity of Chinese populations and economy or whatever, but that actually thinks of it as the same way as, I don't know, the Canadians maybe or something. Okay,
well,
maybe it's not quite there.
They said last week that Canada is Russia's the most anti-Russian country in the world. But this, Mark, and I hope you're right, but I'm also a little bit skeptical because we've been here before, and the Russia that is cooperative with the world has been the exception, not the rule. And that I think the problem isn't necessarily just Putin and this regime. They reflect strands in society that are right now dominant strands in society.
Strands change. I mean, again, I mean, if you looked at Britain in 1950, it's different from Britain from 1970, and it's very different from Britain now. Yes, of course.
But Britain was never resentful against the whole world and thinking that it got a raw deal when it lost its empire. It went through its post-imperial complex, but it went through it in a very different way.
It went through in a very different way, but let's face it, it was because it was in a different position. I mean, there was no way. I mean, Britain had been sort of shattered by war and was also sheltering under the umbrella of, frankly, a very benign and supportive United States. Of course, there's different situations. What I'm just simply saying is, one can't just simply say, unless you're going to actually say there is something in the Russian DNA that makes...
No, and that I don't believe, but...
Otherwise, you just have to accept that there is a process of cultural and therefore political evolution. And yeah, it's painful at the time. And I'm not saying that it actually therefore means that Russia will be our friend in 15 years' time. Because even, you know, there are all kinds of reasons for countries to have animosities with each other. But I'm just simply saying I don't think it's going to be a Putinist Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I have to say, what you're describing actually keeps reminding me of 1984, where you're going to see, you know, Eurasia and East Asia, and you know, they just keep changing, you know, who they're aligning with. I'm not quite sure I'm as sanguine as Mark about Russia's sense of potentially re-embracing the West. It's more that, you know, the other thing to realize in all this is that China has exploited the hell out of Russian, you know, Western tensions in terms of the deals it's been able to get from Russia with respect to energy. And eventually, I can see a world where, as you say, Russia simply resents the Chinese more than they resent the West.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's a case of relative resentment. The resentment is not going to disappear until Russia's economy looks a lot healthier than it does now. And that's going to take a long time.
And it's not just in energy where Russia's making these concessions to China. I mean, there's this, right, this land deal in the Far East and in Siberia where they're basically leasing major chunks of land to China. And I mean, this plays into some fears that Russia has long had about China taking over Siberia. They're creating this reality, and we know how China works when they do this. They develop an area and they bring in their workers, and pretty soon it's de facto Chinese territory. So there's this possibility that this resentment for China could, I mean, I expect Russia to come running back into the embrace of the West, not out of some love for the West, but out of some fear of China down the road.
Well, let's see. I mean, here's the way to put it, which is a scary one, which is you can argue that the only time or, you know, the most significant great power transition in international relations history is when the United States eclipsed the United Kingdom in terms of relative power towards the late 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And it required a concerted effort by the United Kingdom to manage that transition in such a way that it didn't trigger a conflict. There were plenty of potential conflicts that could have turned into a war between those two countries. But in the end, the UK chose not to. UK chose to appease a rising United States. So it was difficult between two countries that had a long history and a common culture. With Russia and China, you know, it's that much trickier because you're talking about countries that are actually bordering each other and have, you know, a long-standing sort of civilizational conflict. So
in this sense, it wouldn't be the Russia that's handing off hegemony to China. It would be China we're talking about China and the West as well. I mean, Russia's kind of caught in the middle between the two, no?
Yeah, although I think Russia thinks of it in a regional sense. I mean, you know, I think part of the issue here is that Russia thinks of itself as a great power and thought of itself as the greatest power on the Eurasian landmass for a long period of time, and that is no longer the case. And I'm not sure Russia has really dealt with that yet.
Yeah, no, I read, I forget where I who wrote this, but I read this week in preparing for this podcast that basically in trying to use things like BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as tools to keep their global influence, Moscow has essentially ceded regional hegemony to China in Central Asia.
Yeah, although I think the other thing is that Central Asia is the one area where, as near as I can determine, China also recognizes that there's not a lot of upside for China to sort of bigfoot its way into Central Asia to kick out Russian influence. That's the sort of, you know, that would be a, to some extent, that's a red line for Russia. And I'm not sure China, frankly, wants that responsibility of having, you know, the sort of Central Asian states be client states. It wants to be able to build the infrastructure there for, for all a variety of economic reasons. But I think it's perfectly happy to let Russia think of it as its playground, so long as China, you know, extends its influence over everywhere else in the Eurasian lands.
Although the interests begin to clash when we talk about energy, because China would like to buy its energy direct from the Central Asian countries, not take
true.
It through Russia, and they want to build pipelines, and that's another area where this relationship is going to run into difficulties. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, really, we're talking about sort of a new era of informal empire in which actually it's money rather than necessarily troops and other forms of boots on the ground that really matter. I mean, from China's point of view, sure, maybe sort of Far Eastern land are significant, but to a large extent, it really just wants to be able to buy everything that it wants and to buy it as cheap a price as possible. I mean, as we saw with the energy deal, and Dan's absolutely right, that they thoroughly, enthusiastically, and gleefully screwed the Russians, knowing how far Putin needed a deal. And therefore, I think, again, when we come back to it, of course there are going to be problems. And I don't actually think that in 10 years' time, Russia will necessarily be, you know, have worked its way through all its various current neuroses and such like. But I am a bit more skeptical about whether or not we actually have such a straightforward sort of geopolitical swing of you're our enemy and now you're our ally against our new enemy or whatever. When it comes down to it, if actually having a lot of Chinese money flooding into your country helps you live a good life, helps the government stay in power, helps you actually keep your economy afloat, which is what really allows you to assert what little authority you still have, and the Chinese aren't, and who knows, again, this is the other element, you know, today's Chinese may well be different from 10 years' time's Chinese. Assuming that the Chinese aren't currently sort of going through a period in which they feel the need to publicly rub the Russians' nose in the relative relationship, I don't think it necessarily means that we have to have that antagonistic relationship. I mean, it's absolutely clear that certainly for the moment, barring some extraordinary catastrophe, China is still rising and Russia is most certainly not. The balance of power in Eurasia has already shifted and will continue to shift, especially because actually the Russians are losing one of the last edges they had, which was military. But that's just the nature of the world you live in. You can resent it, you can regret it, but whether in 10 years' time Russia will actively think it can do anything about it, that's another matter.
So you would agree with Dan's metaphor whereby the Great Britain basically passed on and managed the hegemony to the United States, and Russia is doing the same thing with China in Asia right now?
Well, no, because I mean, one was a much, much more consensual and comfortable relationship than the other. There's no way that one could draw the parallel between Britain and the United States. Ultimately, you bunch may have been revolting colonials, but you're at least revolting colonials who spoke the right language and look right. that's not, I think, how the Russians would think about the Chinese. No, I mean, it's going to be a much more fractious and resentful and grudging process. But there comes a point when actually you have to decide whether you want to hold a grudge or hold a big wadge of currency in your wallet. And I think when it comes down to it, the latter will eventually win out.
No, I'm still expecting the swing back to the West out of the fear of the Chinese. Actually, that's where if you ask me where I think
that'll be. I think it's going to be there, but I think that's very much, you might say, going to be a transitional thing. That's the kind of thing which I could expect out of a Putin regime. We'll just have to see again what kind of thing we get, not just post-Putin, but post-post-Putin.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that the Putin regime is the default, but I think we're going to see regimes along this line. I, again, I, what follows Putin, I expect to be very similar to Putin.
But there's another angle to consider, which is, I mean, from the West perspective, which partner does, you know, the United States or Europe want to do business with more, China or Russia? And actually, that would be a more interesting cleavage to consider, which is that from the U.S. perspective, I guarantee you the U.S. likes doing business with China much more so than Russia. I think the U.S. thinks of Russia or China at this point as, yes, a potential rival, but also there's been a productive relationship. I mean, even during this period where ostensibly China rising has created Sino-American tensions, you are seeing progress on areas like climate change or, you know, reducing conflict in terms of freedom of the seas or, you know, international trade and so forth. Whereas on the other hand, the U.S. relationship with Russia is pretty frozen. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in Europe, you can see why the European Union would think that Russia matters more than China, although it's not quite – there are reasons why they would choose to side with China more. But I could see – you could see a situation where Europe decides that it's worth siding with Russia more than China, whereas the United States decides the reverse.
Hmm.
If you want to get into that great power game.
Yeah, well, and that's what we appear to be headed into, although it's a 21st century hybrid version of this old game. Anybody got any last thoughts before we wrap it up for the week?
One last thought, again, just from what Dan was saying, which I think was spot on, but also I was wondering how far, going back to his earlier points about potential Muscovite exasperation with having to deal with the amateurs in Athens, how far actually from the outside world's point of view, again, there is this issue of at least dealing with the Chinese, you feel you're dealing with professionals. Putin and co, then they're not amateurs, but the way they behave is a lot more problematic. So again, it also just comes down to the human dynamics of who do you think you can trust? Who do you think you can strike a long-term deal with?
Mm. No, I would just to piggyback on that. I mean, I think in some ways we tend to, in political science, we tend to discount individual, you know, idiosyncrasies because usually they don't matter. But you can argue we're now living in a world where you have, you know, the rise of populist parties means the introduction of leaders that you haven't had to deal with before and leaders that aren't used to dealing with international politics before. And that does lead to occasional strange moments.
Mm. Okay, and we've had plenty of those lately. And on that note, we'll wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the recently published book, Spetsnaz, Russia's Special Forces, as well as of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Newton, Massachusetts, has been Daniel Dresner, a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, a senior research fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of the books Theories of International Politics and Zombies and The System Worked, How the World Stopped Another Great Depression. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening and lively discussion.
It's been fun.
Thanks a lot.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.